So our next talk, presentation is by Thomas Ravinius. We actually saw, I believe, the oblate star in our previous talk. So now we'll hear much more.
Yeah, that is Ahana.
Ahana.
Alpha Eri.
Okay,
let's see. I said it wrong.
The end of the river, or the beginning, as you counted. Ahana is a very well-known BE star. It's actually the brightest in the sky. And so let me tell you a bit of the emission history of Ahana, what happened so far. That here is since the about 50s. You see that it never has been a very strong BE star. It's a BE star that is famous for just no emission. Then when it says strong here, that is relative. Then it goes back to no emission at all for 5 years. Then another emission episode goes back. Another emission episode goes back in the 2000s. So it is a relatively weak, very active, in a sense very active BE stars, because it constantly produces a disk and lets it decay again. It is also a BE star that is seen at more or less almost edge-on level, because it is a near-shell star. The photometry does not show any variability. The photometry except pulsation, but on a scale of the disk, from the scattering point of view, the photometry is just flat. And actually, there just now by Domiziano de Sousa have been published new parameters. And from that paper, I think these are the final ones, because if you look in the literature in the last 20 years or so, you find hugely discrepant parameters. But I think these are finals, and you see the equatorian to Keplerian velocity is 84%. It's down from 90 whatever to 84. The reason for this is that in the previous determination, it was measured interferometrically when there was still a residual disk, and this was measured when there was absolutely no disk. So I think these numbers here are relatively final. Important here is the V sine I is 260. And from this, you can then, and taking the 260 and this together, the Keplerian velocity just above the surface is 310. So these two numbers are important to remember, 260 and 310. In a quiescent versus active phase, it looks like this. So the black one is 2000 ferrous spectrum, and here you see a pure Balmer absorption line. This is H alpha, this is a helium line, this is just crap. And that is an active year, 2006, where you see H alpha in emission. Now if you take the difference of the two, you would have a very nice clear emission line, and here is not so clear what would happen, but we will look at this in the next slide. That is now here in the blue region. This is H delta, H epsilon, this here are helium lines, and this here is actually the difference of 2006 minus 2000. So in the Balmer lines, you clearly do see the emission. These wings here, the rems, that might be scattering contribution. But you see a funny signature here in the actual spectral lines. Now, this here is in all the helium lines, what you see, you have we'll look at this in the next slide in a bit larger scale, but you see you have sort of first goes down, then goes up, then goes down again. So it's a sort of emission absorption pattern in all these lines. Here, this is the calcium line, and here you have this absorption, another absorption, and a third absorption. So that is the close-ups. Absorption. So what is this? First of all, what is it not? It is not due to the normalization effect of the changing photometry, because if you in a normal BE star, if it gets brighter, the depth of the line changes. That's okay, but this is not the case here, because such an effect would not change would not sometimes go absorption and then emission. It would either change, it would just produce a reflex of the line, either positive or negative. So it has nothing to do with the fact that there is a disk scattering. It is also not immediately due to different pulsation strength, which was in the case in the two years. This year is the 2000 average profile, 2006 average profile. And you see that in 2000, here the profile seems to be a bit narrower, while in 2006 the profile seems to be a bit wider. That could be because in pulsation is stronger in 2006. However, if you look at the temperance, temporal variance spectrum, which is basically the RMS over all the spectra in that season, you see that also the non-radial pulsation variability is stronger. It does not extend to higher velocities. So outside here, there's no way something outside here could have been produced by pulsation that is further in. So it is not the different pulsation strength. And it is not the disk itself either, any absorption or emission by the disk. Because this is how that looks like. Here you still have this outer wing in the excess wing. And it's the same in calcium, you have this outer excess wing. And this inside here, that is the circumstellar signature. Because the star is a very weak shell star. So what you see here is you see that is the shell contribution to that line by the circumstellar absorption. And you can confirm this actually by the fact that you have a slight inversion down here, which is a CQE, a central quasi-emission. There's a poster outside that this really comes from a Keplerian disk seen edge-on. So there's clear evidence that only the inner part here is from the circumstellar disk, but not these dents here. And since they show up in the difference, they have an actual temporal evolution. They were obviously not there in 2000, because 2000 minus 2000 is zero. And they were actually there in 1999, quite strongly. Early in the year, later in the year, they became weaker. 2001, they were there again. 2002, then they became weaker in 2003, 2004. Completely gone 2004. Strong again in 2006. In some years, there are still features left due to the pulsation. But if you really look at the red marked stripes, this is what we are looking at. These are these excess wings. And these excess wings are variable. They are sometimes there, sometimes not. And now, what do they correlate with? They correlate with the presence of the disk. The red points here are the strength of these excess wings in percent below the continuum. And the black ones are basically the H-alpha equivalent width. You see here, this is the 2000, the decay of the disk, where it goes down back to zero. You see also the excess wing goes down. Here, the disk comes again. Actually, here is already emission. It's just emission and shell absorption balances out to a zero equivalent width. But here, the excess wing is strong. Then it decays again, goes back to zero. And then it comes again. Here is a disk present. And here you have the excess wing again. So, how do we understand them? And in my opinion, what it should be is if you model the star with the parameters I've shown you in the beginning, and then there's only one parameter you need to change to completely produce these variations, and this is V sine I. So whatever you change, like luminosity, effective temperature, beta, doesn't produce such an effect. Only V sine I does produce this effect. This year is what I've shown, 2006 minus 2000, and this is 99 early minus 2000. And this here is models. Model residuals of 250 actually, this was computed, and this here is 260, and this is 285. So what you see here is, I'm ignoring the Balmer lines, which are due to the circumstellar contribution. In the helium lines, you actually see it produces the very same signature. It produces these outer excess wings in absorption and the inner emission. It does not produce that in calcium, but it does not produce it for reasons we do understand. Because in calcium, it does produce these outer wings, which are due to higher V sine I. It does not produce the inner part, which is due to the shell star. And this is what we did not model, so it's absolutely natural that it did not produce it. This is now an old model. Still, the last 3 weeks I was visiting Richard Townsend. We were working on adapting his model, so I hope we soon can do better than that and show it also better that is really the V sine I parameter we have to change here, nothing else. But if it's the V sine I parameter, or the rotation of the star, if you will, how do we understand that? What does it mean in physics? And let me remind you how an outburst, an emission cycle works. It begins, this here is the zero level of the emission. It begins with the feeding of the disk here. Then it rises to a certain level, the emission. That doesn't mean the feeding stops. It just means there is it has reached an equilibrium. Either the disk is full, or it is or this in equilibrium will fall back. Here it starts to decay, and then back to zero. Now, there are two hypotheses. Either the excess rotation triggers the outburst, in which case it should increase in this phase and decay while the disk builds up. Or that's the other possibility, is actually not that the rotation triggers the outburst, but that the disk re-accretes, which it does in any case, parts of it re-accrete, always, and that speeds up the equatorial region. And that would be an anti-correlation with the emission, that would be a correlation with the emission. Because here the re-accretion begins at the same time the disk feeding starts, it becomes weaker when the disk feeding stops, and it decays at the same time with the disk. So,
I'm going to make sure I understand this one. Could you go back?
Can we not count this question, Ben?
All right. I'll ask the
question again.
Go ahead.
That will be on this time, right?
All right, go ahead.
Yeah, it's not much more. I just actually want to show here. We have new data in order to distinguish which of the two possibilities might be the case. And unfortunately, it's not completely clear because... this here is the part I've already shown. There's a new data point here, and there's a new data point here. So here is an extended quiescence of 5 years. You see that the disk has decayed, so has the excess wing. Here, there was absolutely no excess wing, there was no emission, and relatively short after, it was there again, the emission and the excess wing. So that would point to the fact that it is not the rotation that triggers the outburst, but the other way around. Here, however, we have the opposite case. There's absolutely no emission here, and yet it has decayed here. Still there's none. And yet the excess wing is high. So, okay, I don't know what to make out of this. However, so this here certainly was not spin up, because if it was spin up, it should have started here. It should be halfway up there at least. Otherwise, there's no reason to understand this. For this one, since it's a relatively short phase, it should, if this was spin up, it should be as brief as here. So the only way I can make a sense out of this is that you had some outburst here that went unnoticed in spectroscopy, which has actually increased the rotation and has decayed. But that is very speculative. So does the rotation increase before the burst or after? If you assume the same mechanism in both events, it can hardly be spin-up, because we didn't have any spin-up in the second event. It can be re-accretion when you postulate flickering bursts in the first event, but that is a long shot. If you assume a different mechanism in both events, then that problem goes away, but of course we're back to square one, because we still need an underlying trigger for the outburst. So my opinion on this enhanced VSNI is due to re-accretion and is not related with the disk formation process. I'm sure there will be questions a lot. So the next steps is next stars. Yes, there are. 66 of Yuki has lost his disk over 10 years. And if you look at the residuals, this is H alpha Eri again. If you look at the residuals of 66 of Yuki, you actually see the same pattern. So it's actually more, it's not only Achana is common in BE stars. And P. Aquarii is also, here it has actually built up its disks from 1999 to 2000. It's a bit more complicated, this star, because it is earlier than Achana 66 of Yuki, so it is emission in most helium lines. Here it has beta Cepheid pulsation. So this here is the emission, this is the residual signature of the pulsation, but this here could be the rotation again. This here is the helium 2 line. And if you then look at the blue region, you again see the emission, that is the pulsation, and some lines may or may not show this rotational enhancement signature, but that needs to be carefully modeled. That is certainly not bomb-proof. However, I think it's a good indication that it might be there. So, to conclude, This variable V sin I parameter is, I think, a general property of BE stars. It does correlate with the presence of the disk, and in the most simple formation model, it would anti-correlate with the presence of the disk. So, in my opinion, the current data seems to favor that the re-accreted material spins up the equator rather than the rotation triggers the disk ejection. And so what we have to do is to finish the model to model less detailed other stars, and also to model actually the re-accretion for the disk to see whether it really is a nice correlation with the enhanced wings. Thank you.
Thomas?
So yes. let me just go back there, because
Stan was first.
Okay. Yeah, I just wanted to make sure I understood the distinction that there was a yin yang here, that one would give opposite tendencies. I guess the physical question is spinning in my head here: what is the difference between having material in orbit in a nearly critically rotating star and having it be part of the rotation of the star itself? And presumably that means that the star, for the most part, is still rotating somewhat below critical, and when it's in orbit, the material is suspended on its own with Keplerian centrifugal force, but when it's on the surface of the star. But it seems amazing that a small amount of material that you need to make emission could actually show up in something that is a signature for the star itself.
Yeah.
The one thing that would suggest to me is that the actual material would be brighter than it's surrounding. I mean, the material that's just been re-accreted is brighter than the material that's not as gravity darkened, for example.
That's one thing we have to model.
I mean, it seems like
you have to consider that what you need to spin up is probably only a very thin equatorial belt,
yeah,
and only a very thin layer of the photosphere to make it show like this.
To come from there to
yes.
Contribute to the V sin I.
Mm-hmm.
So what I'm wondering about is whether this material somehow, because the energy from it doesn't come from interior, it comes from the fall back, it's actually over bright compared to the gravity.
That's one thing.
Contributes to the
we have to model. That is actually one of the generalizations I asked Rich to put in his model to be able to do that.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I don't know who was next.
Maybe I'm sure this is going to surprise you, but I actually favor your first mechanism. Going back to the Ondo mechanism, I've been awfully impressed with the work of Tammy Rogers and some follow-on work that Rich has been doing about generating angular momentum at the surface. I should say transporting angular momentum to prograde G-modes generated by convection in the core. I talked to Tammy for some length yesterday about Friday, and I asked her the question, what would be the time scale for the changes in these modes? Because that was one of the things her model emphasized that Ondo's did not. And her answer was 2 to 5 seconds. That's one day. And I think that's exactly right, because there are a few instances now from the observations of BE star disks being triggered in 2 days. You send the model.
Okay, last question. Did I miss it, or did you not comment on why this couldn't be some kind of variable turbulent broadening?
Oh, that's actually the point. It might be variable turbulent broadening, and the turbulence is triggered by falling back material.
Yeah, okay. So the difference between turbulence and rotation.
Yeah, okay, but, yeah.
Okay, one last quick question, as we have a minute.
A little correction on the question. Pi Aquarii, I lost the disk in 1996, not 1999.
Yeah, that's what I said. In 1999, it was low, and it built up from 99 to
2001.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank the speaker one more time.